And he, of course, is a Christian. There's no question about his Christian point of view, but he's a certain kind of a Christian. To be specific, which doesn't cover everything, he's an Episcopalian, and he's not ashamed of being an Episcopalian, and his, this particular denomination of his comes out here and there. In fact, he discusses it specifically. He is, as many of you are familiar, I'm sure, an attorney, graduate of Harvard Law School, then went to practice law in Harlem, and was there for 5-6 years, I believe, living right in Harlem. And that's what this book is about, his experiences and his observations and his criticisms on the basis of that life in Harlem. It's not difficult to read in the sense that it's very readable, but there are many points in it that are hard to face, even for those of us who have been hearing about the problems of the poor and the problems of the Negro. Of course, this is very much on the diet of every conference and every speaker almost in the country, so we hear it all the time. But even for us who are fairly hardened, I think he has some points that pierce the armor here and there. I noticed in the back of it that of course, they put these recommendations here. They have a recommendation from Robert Penn Warren, who, of course, is no mean writer, who says in the New York Times review, it's a powerful record written with verve and literary skill. Now, that's, of course, high praise from Robert Penn Warren. And as you read it, you see that it's, he knows how to write, as well as to have experiences. Now,
you might mention he may be on a future faculty here, but I haven't written him so far because he's so much on the speaking circuit right now. These fellows get up here, we find they're kind of drained. They're ready to give a talk, but dialogue comes a little difficult for them.
Very much in demand all over the country, sort of came to the fore as a result of that Harlem experience. And then he was an apt and avid listener to Carl Barth when he was over here, and Carl Barth gave him a high recommendation for being a sharp theological mind, although I don't think he has a theological training. He's trained in law, you see. But he has some very definite ideas of what theology is all about. And as I say, he presents it without beating around the bush, and it's not a pleasant picture, it's not a pleasant book to read, but you sort of are thankful for it anyway. At least that's how I feel about it. And I feel about William Stringfellow, as I feel about so many of these other books, that you have to take him as he is. He's different from some others. He's not just like Ole Hollesby, for instance, of our Norwegian heritage. I suppose he's not even like Martin Luther, though I think he's more like him. He is himself, and you have to take it or leave it. There he is, you know. I don't know whether I found any real profanity in here, but it certainly wouldn't be beyond him, because that's the kind of a person that he is. But he has something to say about Christianity and about society and about democracy, and has all these strong opinions on all of them. Just now, as I'm talking, I just wonder whether Stringfellow has met McCarthy, or whether Senator McCarthy has met Stringfellow.
Is he in his column? I think he is. I mean, I can show you. The New York Times has got him always in Stringfellow's list.
Is he in what?
He was either in Kennedy's or in McCarthy's column. I don't know. I think it's McCarthy.
I'm sure that he would be for one of them, but I'm just wondering whether they had met. Well, he moved into Harlem at the advice of a friend of his, a former fellow student by the name of George Todd. He says he didn't go there on the basis of any inner personal inspiration, but George Todd, who was living there already as a part of the so-called East Harlem Protestant Parish, and I think you've heard about that. And maybe one of those men from there would be a future faculty member here too. George Todd was there already, invited Stringfellow to come in, and so he moved in. And he gives some rather vivid descriptions of the room, or apartment room, I suppose you'd have to call it, into which he moved. Part of that is the opening page. I'll read a little of it. And then a little further on, when he tried to settle down there, he had a little difficulty in that. I can find that here. Page numbering. Well, the smells inside tenement number 78342 East 100th Street, Manhattan, were somewhat ambiguous. They were a suffocating mixture of rotting food, rancid mattresses, dead rodents, dirt, and the stale odors of human life. This was to be home. It had been home before for a family of eight, five kids and three adults. Some of their belongings have been left behind, some of their life too. The place altogether was about 25 by 12 feet with a wall separating the kitchen section from the rest of the kitchen. In the kitchen was a bathtub, a tiny rusty sink, a refrigerator that didn't work, an ancient gas range. In one corner was a toilet with a bowl without a seat. Water dripped perpetually from the box above the bowl. The other room was filled with beds, two double-decker military cots, and a big ugly convertible, etc. This was to be my home. I wondered for a moment why. Then I remembered that this is the sort of place in which most people live in most of the world for most of the time, this or something worse. So this was to be home. Well, the parish had arranged for me to move into this tenement on 100th Street, which was one of the, that's that East Harlem Protestant parish, was one of the, which was, as one of the clergy put it, to be, as he handed me the keys to the place, was typical of the housing in the neighborhood. It was Labor Day, 1956, when I came to the city, and I had checked my luggage at Grand Central Station before going uptown to see my new home. I had taken one precaution for my first inspection of the premises. I had a DDT bomb of the sort that we used in the Army, which I had picked up at a military surplus store. I entered the apartment and looked around and found a dead mouse in the toilet, which I disposed of. I opened the window so as not to DDT myself. I don't understand that, but maybe other people know more about DDT. Then I released the bomb. I sat down on something for a moment to see what would happen. From everywhere, from every crack and corner, from the ceiling and walls, and from underneath the linoleum, from out of the refrigerator and the stove, from back of the sink and under the bathtub, from every place came swarms of creeping, crawling vermin. I shuddered. I remember saying out loud to myself, "Stringfellow, you'll never know whether you have become an alcoholic. Who could tell in such a place whether or not he was having delirium tremens? I left the place, went downtown, had a drink, checked into a hotel, and spent the night there. And then, well, the next day, I better read this too. The next day as it happened, I was to have lunch with Bishop James Pike, who was at that time still dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I told him it was perhaps not the most suitable subject for mealtime conversation about the episode I had just related here. And he replied, "Oh, cheer up, we have cockroaches in the high altar of the cathedral." With that comfort, I returned to East 100th Street. Well, that was his beginning. And then he tells about his the picture of the poor, what it means to be poor. And they are not pleasant pictures. In the city, there's affluence, that's downtown New York. Affluence, inflation, luxury, and power are only a few blocks away. That is, even if you're living on the east side of New York, in Manhattan, downtown. But in Harlem, there is squalor, depression, poverty, and frustration. Harlem is largely neglected by and segregated from the rest of the city. Outside are air purifiers, private toilets, hi-fi, gourmet food, imported cars, and the extra dry martini. Inside Harlem are the smells of sweat and waste, bathtubs in the kitchens, antiquated direct current, predatory vermin, secondhand clothes, and a million empty beer cans in the gutters. Outside the ghetto are secure jobs, some chances for education, and even space to play. Inside, there's chronic unemployment, much illiteracy, and the numbers game. Outside, people have recourse to psychotherapy, positive thinking, carte blanche. Inside, people have narcotics, the pawn shop, and cadres of social workers. In Harlem, Park Avenue becomes a railroad track. So, of course, that's just a little part of it. He has page after page of this picture of poverty. And one of the questions that comes to one reading it, well, what is the good of all this extended description of poverty? In any case, population density is very great in Harlem, and it is greatest in East Harlem, in my view. In my view, social workers spend too much time with statistics, but they do know their statistics. And one social worker I know computes that if the entire population of the United States, 190 million people, I see it's a few years ago, lived in as severe proximity to people as people in fact do live in East Harlem, the whole population of the United States could live in the five boroughs of New York City. I do not have the imagination to visualize these computations, but I do see the block where I myself have lived. There, among 4,000, about 4,000 people, an entire village really, inhabit 27 crumbling tenement buildings, 4,000 people. Well, this goes on and on in book pictures of poverty. He went into Harlem and didn't try to drum up business, but he thought he'd just stay there and see what happened, just be a presence there. He was there 2-3 months before anybody noticed him at all. Then gradually people came to find out that he was a lawyer, and so they came to him for help. He calls that the existential way of promoting legal activity there. See if I can see this now. 46. Speaks of the street as a pretty good office for carrying on law activity. What is the best preparation for carrying on legal work in Harlem? According to him, it's not a degree from Harvard Law School or having passed the bar or being a very sharp lawyer, but to have actually lived in and felt in yourself what he calls the vulnerability of the poor. To practice law in Harlem requires more than a professional identification with these kinds of cases. It involves more than knowledgeability about the neighborhood and something different from just sympathy for the people of the ghetto. Humanitarian idealism is pretentious in Harlem and turns out to be irrelevant. That's the type, that's his general type of approach. That most of what he's done is, according to him, useless. Well, that's one of the things we can discuss. What do you do with statements like that? It is rather more important, he says, to experience the vulnerability of daily life. It is necessary to enter into and live within the ambiguity and the attrition of human existence. In a way, it is even more simple than that. It is just essentially to become and to be poor. So he felt that's the main thing as far as of really getting next to these people and being able to do anything for them. Well, that sounds very good. There's another passage, though, where he describes, I can find that, a day, his own day. In Harlem. When he was first working there. See how this sounds to you. I don't know, when you read a book like this, at least for me, it's something like when I listen to a speaker. I can be ashamed of myself, maybe, about it, but you know, I'm putting him up and putting him down and seeing where he's wrong in this and where he's right in this, and shall I praise him more? Shall I think well of him? Shall I think less of him? And is this where he's all wrong? And this is where. That's the way one does, at least I do, when I read this kind of a book, too. So here William Stringfellow also says, I found my own practice. I don't want to let you off from the impact of this book by reading this passage, but in other words, I'm not interested really in making it more easy for myself or for you, but I found my own practice of the law in Harlem intellectually provocative. Therefore, I continued to write and speak about some of the issues of the law and the philosophy of the law with faculty and students from the law schools and with fellow lawyers. I'm an Episcopalian, and I had long been active in the affairs of the Episcopal Church. This continued during the time in Harlem, in participation in the congregation to which I belonged, and in many other ways, although in another book. One of the most scathing things that I ever read was his description of his assignment to teach a Sunday school class in that parish, and what they wanted him to do and what he wouldn't do, you know. Of course, I can criticize him on that too. He was doing for weeks there the same thing that you said you were going to do these evening classes, Carol, and just read the New Testament. Only he stuck to one chapter, I think. He brought those boys back Sunday after Sunday, and they just read through the same chapter. And he said, what does this mean? And he brought them back to it. But he was nevertheless a member of the church, even though he didn't believe in the way the church was doing its work. The continuing participation in the congregation to which I belong, many other ways as well. I am a white man, and to live in Harlem did not mean that I needed to be separated from white society. In fact, as I reflect upon it, there was a marvelous luxury in living and working in Harlem, of somehow being free and able to transcend a lot of barriers that otherwise separate men from each other. In the course of the day, I crossed a good many boundaries. By the way, I didn't read the passage where he describes how he fixed up that room, you know, and all the putty he put into the cracks and all that sort of got to be livable. So he had a livable room up there. But in the course of the day, I crossed a good many boundaries. Perhaps I would be in court in the morning with an addict or a kid from one of the gangs. I then have lunch with a law professor at Columbia or NYU, interview clients back at 108th Street during the afternoon, have a drink with some of Harlem's community leaders at Frank's Chop House, 125th Street, have dinner with clergy friends and with fellow parishioners at a Midtown restaurant, stop for a bull session with some of the law students or seminarians, and spend the evening talking with friends in the Harlem neighborhood. Or I might return to the tenement to read or write, or more often than not, do a little more work in rehabilitating the place, go out to get the Times and talk with people on the streets. I crossed a lot of boundaries in the course of a day. That is itself not so important. What is very important is that in crossing boundaries of class and race and education and all the rest, a man remains himself. What is important is not what a man is, but who a man is, and that he remains the same wherever he is. Now he describes another instance about after he'd been there for a little while, one of the young people there said they noticed that he polished his shoes every day. And he said, well, isn't that all right? Oh, yes. He said, shouldn't I polish my shoes? Oh, yes. But the thing is, I noticed that you keep on polishing them also after you move to Harlem. And then he has quite a long discussion about that, the importance of maintaining identity. Once he took one of the young fellows with him over when he was speaking at Union Seminary. He said he had been invited to speak at Union Seminary, and he always liked to invade the enemy's camp as much as possible. And so he went there and took this boy along with him and gave his lecture. And the boy said he liked it very much. He said, because you talk to them the same way you talk to us. So I don't know if we can say that he prides himself on that identity, but he makes a great point of it, and of course it's a very important one. Now in his whole discussion of poverty, he comes back to the subject that those of you who have heard William Stringfellow or read his books know is quite central in his thinking. He thinks that the big, and so far you might say that he's like the great German philosopher, nothingness, you know, Western Germany.
Heidegger.
I don't know why I can't remember Heidegger's name, but I've been in that position several times. Heidegger, you know, the nothingness. Well, he doesn't use nothingness, but he uses death. In fact, he came to Augsburg College for a commencement speech and talked, really, it seemed to most people, I think, not very interestingly about death. And he didn't get any great response from those young people. But when he talks about the subject in his books, I think you have quite an atmosphere of reality about it. And he says the thing about the poor is that they have a more direct access to the fact of death as prevalent and, you might say, dominant in human life. What sophistication the suffering of the poor, what sophisticates the suffering of the poor is not innocence or extremity, nor loneliness, nor the fact that it is unknown or ignored by others, but rather, and here's the big, great advantage of the poor, according to William Stringfellow. This, I'm sure, is something that you want to perhaps disagree with or discuss. But rather the lucidity, the straightforwardness with which it bespeaks the power and presence of death among men in the world. Among the poor, death is clear and lucid and ever present. The awful and ubiquitous claim of death is not different for the poor than for other men, or for that matter, for nations or ideologies or other principalities or powers. But among the poor, there are no grounds to rationalize the claim, no way to conceal the claim, no facile refutation of the claim, no place to escape it or even evade it. Now, Stringfellow says that's the basic fact of life, and this the poor are living with constantly. Now, I say whether you agree with that or not, that's another question, but that's his view. Now, he discusses other things. He discusses the housing problems and goes into them in considerable detail. The rents go up, and then they bring in new city urban renewal and all that means. Well, I'm sure we're familiar with many discussions like that, and some of us live right close to it too. But he has a long discussion on that point, the power of death, and the works of the political side of things. He goes into that at great length, and how the politicians make use of poverty to further their ends. There aren't very many people that William Stringfellow was really very pleased with, according to his books. However, he does, I think, in every possible place, slant the judgment in favor of the poor and the outcast and the Negro and these. For instance, he says about the something I haven't finished about. He says that these gang people in Harlem, they're willing to give their lives even for unworthy causes. Most of us aren't willing to give our lives even for a worthy cause, but they will die for the worst sort of things. Now, is that the higher type of morality, or isn't it? He at least raises the question. His description of the schools is not very encouraging. You might think, well, I'm lengthening this out too much, but I just want to give the picture as he gives it as a background for his criticism. Here's this little incident about the schools. The parents of the student, this is in Harlem again, the parents of the students and some of the teachers had long been complaining as to the educational administration and to their political representatives about the conditions in the building. A newspaper took up their complaints and ran some articles exposing the situation. Finally, and only after months of pressure, the mayor of New York, and then he characterized him, he's a man of extravagant apathy, decided to visit the premises so they can see, and that's not the present mayor of New York, we might mention. This is typical of the mentality which rules the political administration of New York. That is, no issue or problem or crisis is acted upon until it becomes so notorious that some sort of action is a political and public necessity. There's little evidence that the mayor seriously cares about such problems until his own public self-interest becomes in some fashion involved. And even then, the action taken to appease the press and public is more often than not a gesture, like the appointment of a mayor's committee to investigate, or a visit from the mayor to find out for himself what is going on, and possibly that he will remedy whatever is amiss. Well, in this case, the mayor came. He arranged to visit the school in question, inspect the premises, and speak to the students, teachers, and parents assembled for his visitation. The day came, and the mayor, accompanied by a retinue of photographers and reporters, was about to mount the platform when, by what I am disposed to consider an act of God, a huge rat ran across the stage. The incident was duly reported in all the newspapers, and of course the school had to be closed at least until the rats had been exterminated. This was done. The school reopened a couple of weeks later after it was said that the exterminators had carted off more than 200 rat carcasses. Then the students and teachers returned, but they had to be evacuated again promptly. Well, so on. Not all schools in Harlem are like this one, but the point is that far too many of them are, says William Stringfellow. And so on and so on. You just no end to all the bad things that he presents here. And then, of course, that this is so largely related to the fact of segregation and then the overpopulation in certain areas. The chapter on involvement, he has a chapter on acceptance. He finds that he was really accepted in Harlem when one of his Negro friends there had pointed out to his girlfriend that she could serve the needs of William Stringfellow whenever it was necessary. Figures that showed that he really was accepted in the community. He describes a meeting which he attended, if I can get that. And this is all background for his picture of the relation between whites and blacks. The meeting had been called to consider whether anything could be done to expose and oppose the police brutality in Harlem. About 30 people were at the meeting. Some were clergymen, others journalists, a few were businessmen, some were in politics, some represented civil rights organizations, and some were attorneys. All, as it happened, were Negroes, except myself. I was late in arriving at the meeting, which was held in Central Harlem, having been in court all morning on a case, by coincidence, regarding police abuse. Most of those present were friends. By now, we had worked together in a variety of matters, and we knew and trusted each other. There were two persons present whom I had not yet met. The chairman of the meeting interrupted the discussion when I came in and introduced me to the two to whom I was a stranger. "This is Bill Stringfellow," she said. "He's a lawyer over in East Harlem. I've known him for about 5 years. It's safe for you to talk in front of him." Well, now, little incident, you see, is how one little part of his total picture of this terrific lack of trust between the Negro and the white. And of course, you can read a little bit of Stringfellow's pride here. See, he's the only white man there. We can talk safely in front of him. And that leads on. There are many other things here too, but it leads on to his statement of his conviction that the statement of the conviction that they're very likely will be increasing actual conflict, warfare, between the whites and the blacks. And now this book was written, I think, 1963. And as you read his prophecies, you see that, and think of what we lived through in 1967, and you feel like saying, well, is William Stringfellow also among the prophets? He says here that the strife will be worse in the northern cities, worse than in the south, because, he says, the northern cities have already, partly chiefly as a result of the Second World War, they have granted the things for which the Negroes are fighting in the south, are contending in the south today, have already been achieved in the north. And the experience of the north, of real conflict, in order to achieve greater rights for the Negroes is the foretaste of what will later come to the southern cities. That's his his view. He relates a dream. I happen to have so many dreams all the time, and I'm always interested in dreams. In fact, I dreamed night before last that I was called on to speak at a meeting, and I was, you know, called on to speak. I was supposed to speak. I was 5 minutes late in the first place, and I wasn't prepared at all. I don't know if that was related to what's was going on here or not, but here's William Stringfellow's dream. On one of those steaming, stinking, stifling nights that summer brings to Harlem tenements, I had a dream. In the dream, I was walking in Harlem on 125th Street in broad daylight. I seemed the only white man in sight. The passers-by stared at me ruefully. Then two Negroes stopped me and asked for a light. While I searched my pockets for a match, one of them sank a knife into my belly. I fell. I bled after a while. I died. I woke quickly. I felt my stomach, but there wasn't any blood. I smoked a cigarette and thought about the dream. The assault in the dream seemed unprovoked and vicious. The death in the dream seemed useless, and therefore all the more expensive. The vision in the dream, or the victim in the dream, seemed innocent of offense against those who murdered him, except the victim was a white man. The victim was murdered by black men because he was a white man. The murder was retribution. The motive was revenge. No white man is innocent. I am not innocent. Then I thought. Now, I heard William Stringfellow say some of these things personally in a small conference a few years ago, and I certainly didn't pay the attention to them then that I do now. Since then, I've heard Negroes too say, "Well, the only way that any attention will be paid to us is through violence." You see. And you can see it. There are all kinds of things that have resulted from violence that didn't result before. We've been talking for 100 years. And so quite calmly they say it is necessary to oppose the evil of the white man with violence, because nothing else works. Now, William Stringfellow seems to have accepted the reality of that point of view quite a bit ahead of most northern leaders, most Christian leaders today. This is, you might say, it isn't the only point. I don't know if it's the main point of his book, but it certainly is one of the points. Now the book closes. Or he closes his book with a very wonderful story about a young man named Lou Marsh, a young Negro who had managed to get an education all the way into Yale Divinity School. And then after great struggle with himself, you know, these Negroes are tempted to hate themselves for being Negroes. Because of the tremendous disadvantage of being a Negro. But he had come through that, so he had come again to be able to love himself and to love others. And then went to work with these youth gangs in Harlem as a member of the so-called youth board. And because he had been successful in pacifying a conflict between two of the gangs, so that they weren't going to go into what they call a rumble, he was beaten to death, clubbed to death, by some of the leaders of the other gang who believed in fighting and didn't believe in pacification. That's how he closes his book, and I suppose that is the main point. He called it The Way to Live. Lou Marsh had found the way to live, and he really wasn't wholly surprised by the form of his death. And Stringfellow really isn't too surprised by the form of Lou Marsh's death either, because he says, "Why, it's the Christian teaching that crucifixion is necessary. Suffering, not only on the part of those who are guilty, but on the part of those who are innocent, in order that the reconciliation may be achieved." So that's kind of the high point to which he comes in the book. The triumph, the price that has to be paid if reconciliation is to be achieved. Now, I want to mention one thing more, and this is by no means the least important. In fact, in some ways, it's the most important thing in the book. He went to live in Harlem as a member of the so-called East Harlem Protestant Parish. And I think most of us have, well, I mentioned it just a minute ago, and we've heard of it. Books have been published. For instance, we have a very wonderful little book called Come Out the Wilderness, by one of those East Harlem men. He went there as a member of their team. There were about a dozen of them, most of them from Union Seminary. But he found himself pretty largely in disagreement with them, so he didn't stay with them so terribly long, about 15 months or so. And some of the most interesting parts of this book are where he tells about his impressions of that parish and how they do things. It's very how they did things. According to him, ignorant well-meaningness. You see, they didn't know how things should be done. But that is. See if I can find that. Through its first years in the neighborhood, the parish had become deeply conformed to the world. Conformity to the world is a temptation which assails the church no less in the slums than in the suburbs. Conformity to the world exists wherever and whenever the church regards its message and mission to be principally determined by or essentially dominated by the ethos of secular life and the society which surrounds the church. The young men ministers who had come from Union Theological Seminary to found East Harlem Partisan Parish were much tempted to such conformity. They had seen the Protestant churches abandon the inner city, both physically and psychologically, and were aroused by the attachment and by this attachment and conformity of Protestantism to middle-class American society. They would bring the ministry of Protestantism back into the inner city and work there among the poor and the dispossessed. In doing so, they were confronted with how the ministry could be exercised in the midst of the long festering complex, and to them, because they were white middle-class and upper-class people, unfamiliar social problems. These problems, they brought two things. They were very much, these young men from Union Seminary, very disgusted with and critical of the church outside. And secondly, the thing that they brought was a real desire for social reform. And Stringfellow concludes this part of his summary of it. Ironically, in spite of their rejection of middle-class Protestantism, the group ministry initially seems to have seen as its task to make the East Harlem neighborhood as nearly middle-class as possible by changing the social order. Now, William Stringfellow thinks this is all a mistake to go in there and simply change the number of bathtubs and the and so on. In any event, he says, the preaching and service of the gospel do not depend on any special social changes, ideational or any other way. The gospel does not even depend upon the American way of life. The church is much tempted to conformity to the world by accommodating the message and mission to the particular side in which the church happens to be, whether it's in the slums or in the suburbs. Instead of honoring the integrity of the gospel for all societies and for all sorts and conditions of men in all times and places, this temptation beguiled the group ministry of the East Harlem Protestant Parish. They plunged into all sorts of social work and social action, narcotics, politics, neighborhood improvements, education, housing, and the rest. They insisted therapy, they instituted therapy and counseling for addicts, engaged in voter registration, lobbied for new playgrounds, organized PTAs, complained about the slum landlords, and generally made themselves a nuisance to those in power in the neighborhood. It was in many ways an admirable, if idealistic, and in Christian terms, a naive effort, says William Stringfellow. They neglected and postponed the proclamation and celebration of the gospel in East Harlem. Congregations of the parish, the Bible was closed. In the group ministry, there was an even scorn for the Bible as a means through which the Word of God is communicated. And he tells about how he tried to get them to start reading the Bible again. Furthermore, they had a scorn for the regular churches. In such circumstances, the hostility of the group ministry toward the church outside East Harlem, and indeed toward other churches within the East Harlem unaffiliated with the parish. See, they thought they had the answer. See, they've got the church there. Like St. Edward the Martyr or the Chambers Memorial Baptist Church, Roman Catholic churches, they became very arrogant and proud. Not long after I came from East Harlem, one of the clergy in the group ministry blandly explained that the church, that is the East Harlem church, the church outside East Harlem was dead. The East Harlem Protestant parish represented the New Jerusalem, to use the exact words of American Protestantism, the example through which American Protestantism would be purified and renewed. The calling of the parish, he said to me, was to be the norm in all essential realms of the church's life for the whole church in America. And Henry William Stringfellow says it's all humbug, he says. And what does he want? Well, he wants to pay some attention to the Bible. Now, I know we have some theologians here. He's got something to say about that, too. In the heart of the conflict and disunity regarding the place of the Bible in the church, other churches outside Harlem, was a fundamental misapprehension about what the Bible is. Now, I have no inclination toward biblical literalism, but neither do I think that the Bible can be neglected, as the liberal Protestants fondly do, save for the teachings of Jesus. I'm no biblical scholar either, but I affirm the necessity of for the most rigorous work of texture, and I affirm the necessity for the most rigorous work of textual criticism, but I do not become greatly distressed by demythologizing the Bible. Indeed, it is to be used as an excuse, unless it is to be used as an excuse for banishing the Bible from contemporary life. None of these approaches to the Bible essentially affects our reliance upon the Bible. Now, that's, you see, a kind of a that he confused some of the others of being naive. This sounds almost naive. But here he says the thing to do is simply get back to the Bible and read it and talk about it and listen to the Word of God through it. And yet, at the same time, he certainly is in favor of social reform. He's kind of a lonely voice. You can understand what he meant. He'd like to go up to Union and talk in the enemy's camp, because some of these simplicities would not be don't know if we have any union students here, but that's his implication, that they wouldn't be, that they wouldn't be received there. Well, I think the time is just about up. And you can see that there are a good many questions here that certainly deserve deserve discussion. What is the approach? What about how much should we be involved in as a church in correcting social conditions? There was an editorial in the what was that? Yes, I think that was in the last number of the Standard that dealt with just this same thing. You see that in fact it regarded the now that it comes to me, it regarded the coming ALC convention when the editor was afraid that the church will go overboard and become so taken up with various social reform activities, even though, I can put in parentheses, even though what this particular church can accomplish along that line is relatively minor, you know. And even if you put in a few million dollars, as I think Carol here, Carol isn't here right now, suggested in a, be back there, in a letter to me, you see it's nothing but a drop, really, you know. But you see, we don't really realize how unimportant we are. Where are we going to find the straight way, the right balance? Well, I wrote many things about William Stringfellow that I don't like, as I've told you, and some of the worst ones I haven't read from the book. Read them for yourself. But he has a message that that sort of calls us to order and says, well, how about this? Isn't this supposed to be Christianity? And what is Christianity? He thinks Christianity is devotion to the Word of God. I never can find out fully exactly what he means by the Word of God, but that's his. I don't know if we're supposed to adjourn now or if there's a bell rings or what. It's probably
there'll be a bell at 12, but there's still time for any questions. I haven't read much of Stringfellow. How much have some of you read?
Say, you are there.
What
is that?
Well, I think it'd be kind of fun to see how much they've read of Stringfellow and how they
yes.
feel about it.
Yes, yes, because he is controversial. He is controversial.
He's usually considered, isn't he, Paul, about the number one layman in the church today, as far as...
Well, he's played up that way, and is that a bad thing or a good thing? Anybody who's a number one layman, you know, immediately, like the Kagawa, the greatest Christian of our time. I don't like that way of expressing, but I know that he's very much in demand everywhere, everywhere. How many of you have read any of his other books? For instance, the first one that came out was Private and Public Faith. And you've read that one?
No.
What's that?
I've read some of his articles.
The articles, yeah.
That's all I have. Marion does my reading. She reads books.
Well, maybe it's all right that we discuss this one this morning then, because again, what I said, what I'm interested in really in these hours is that to find a pathway to better and finer Christian living. That's really what we're interested in. And this book is certainly not as does not have as much of a contribution as many others do, but it is a kind of a.
Julia's read them, and I'll just say four since she's got the B matches. He's right about the gospel, and right on the issues of this war. She's one of our women theologians here.
No, I'm not.
She is too.
I think that I'm saying, Carol, that one thing that strikes me
about
Stringfellow is the way he deals with scoring the poor, the things he talks about. What one would get only by living there, as he did. And I never lived in town, but I worked for 20 years. And just in that, you get a different view of a group. They cease to become a group of statistics with so many bathrooms and so many bathtubs. And he somehow seems to have gotten inside of people. And this, you know, this whole thing about this, about death, and these kinds of things, I think, really have to be seriously listen to him. I think he's got a handle here on some things. Just because he was with people, you know, day in and day out, and not going into social work or that sort of thing.
He's not a professionalist of the whole thing. He's living with them to serve them. So he sees with different eyes. I mistrust caseworkers and professionals myself, but he's living there as another human being.
He's a kind of a strange combination of a profound criticism of the church and yet a profound insistence on the church, the liturgy and the worship and all these things. He says those young fellows in Harlem, they didn't really know what Christianity was. Now, I don't know whether that's fair to their courses in church history at Union, but that's what he says. They just pay attention to themselves and their own little programs and get out of the mainstream of the church. Somebody else.
Was he associated in any way with this Ramparts magazine? Is that someone?
No, that's the West Coast View.
Yeah, but he'd be likely to be writing in it.
Yeah, me in Britain. I think now one of his, I remember reading how sympathetic a few of them, he gets an agnostic friend to go to church with him finally on Sunday morning. You know, so he can experience worship and hear the gospel. And of course, he like he says, he was listening, you know, with the ears of his friend, and unable to get a thing out of it, because the fellow just wasn't on at all. It wasn't the Word of God, it wasn't the Gospel, and he was so distressed himself that he had to go back to church again for himself later, just because he'd got nothing except just the feeling of dismay at there. How could this ever win anybody to anything, you know? Well, certainly all of us have had this sensation. I can remember two boys in my own relations here finally got a friend of theirs. These two Pauls who were up here this last week, they finally got a friend of theirs who is a high school agnostic. You go to church in a Sunday morning. And it was so awful that they couldn't believe it. They had to go to communion for forgiveness just because of their hatred for the preacher. And letting them down. And it took them a year to get this mother to go to church. And then the preacher just didn't have a thing for them. You know. Well, you know, there are things here where he just touches it off, and if you're a listener at all, you certainly can hear with his ears and feel his dismay.
Now, he condemns me also in this way. He is doing and talking ways that I don't approve of, see? Then I say, is that my narrow-mindedness? Or what is this? I don't feel like going down and having a drink with somebody down at a bar. Is that my narrow-mindedness, or is this William Stringfellow's effectiveness in dealing with people? See? So let's say he's in some ways a nonconformist. But then I like to get myself out of it a little bit by criticizing him and saying, well, after all, it's a nice life. That's what I'd like to do. Talk in the morning with the Negroes, in the afternoon with the lawyers, and in the evening with the bishops, and have a good night's rest afterward. That's the kind of a life I like, see? But in on the other hand, it's a little bit like we criticize Robert Kennedy, you see, living in luxury. But living in that luxury, he was using his words to do something on behalf of those that are a different kind. But you know, it's quite a sting at the bishop, and he says, well, he said, the room full, well, we had a cockroach up in our 15th.
You said that he wasn't well received the time you heard him talk about death.
No, he was in my, but Carlos, you were there, weren't you?
Yes.
He didn't get that message across.
Well, I think it's actually through the graduation exercise. See, the kids go out to face life. And the title of the talk was The Meaning of Death.
Yes, he wrote a book on that.
I heard it once.